Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
To be really frank and to be perfectly honest, this is a really strange time to be hosting a sports radio program. I mean, really, really strange. In fact, the truth is, really strange does not come close to doing it justice. But why don't we go with that phrasing for right now? Because for nearly 3 months, there have not been sports. Pretty much zero sports. So, when people say, stick to sports, my answer would be, what sports would you like me to stick to? What game from last night would you like me to talk about? But even in the event that there were sports right now, even if we were right in the middle of the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup Final, preparing for the U.S. Open in golf, and MLB was heating up, it would still feel very strange to talk about sports right now. Now, don't get me wrong. I can. I've got three interviews scheduled, as I mentioned. I'm looking forward to all of them. We could talk about what's happening with the return of the NBA and the NHL seasons. We could talk about why MLB is throwing up all over itself again. But does it really seem that important at this very moment? Can you honestly say that that's what we should be thinking about and doing right now? Is that the right thing when there are protests happening around the country, when people are being tear gassed, when there is looting? And I'll get to more on that in a moment. With all of this happening, it just seems really strange to come with a really hard take about Dak Prescott's contract negotiations today. Now, I also understand that people like to treat sports as an escape. But there's nothing to escape to right now. There are no games. There are no events. And that's a good thing. Because for far too long, sports have been a place where people try to block out the reality of the world. And if the people playing those sports, if they want to talk about the realities they face, then they're told inevitably to stick to the sport they play. Now, I want to play a clip from University of New Orleans athletic director Tim Duncan, talking about an experience that he had recently.
Hello, my name is Tim Duncan. I'm director of athletics at the University of New Orleans. And 5 days before George Floyd was murdered, my wife and I were stopped in Newton, Massachusetts, just one block from our home, walking to the store. We were stopped by 4 police cars, 6 policemen with guns drawn because we fit a profile, because I fit a profile. I wanted to take some time to think about that. I wanted to take some time to speak to our student athletes before making a statement. I know that it's been, you know, over a week now since the murder has occurred. I haven't said anything publicly. I wanted to take some time to think about that. I'm disappointed in myself over the past few years in my life because I had begun to normalize these situations. I remember the talk that my mom and dad had given me about race and police and from the time that I was a child. And if you're really interested in knowing how to have these talks with your children, you should pick up Sonia Whitaker Gregg's book, Mama, Have You Heard the News? It's about race and police and how to have these conversations with your kids. It's an excellent read. So, but yeah, I'd had the talk, so I felt pretty confident that, you know, things would turn out all right. And they did for me. But it's not okay. It's not okay that just because I'm a tall black man walking one block from his house, that I'm pulled over and say I fit a profile of a murder suspect just because he was tall. And I understand the police have to do their job, trust me, they do. But to roll down on me with guns drawn when I'm walking on a beautiful Wednesday afternoon with my wife is uncalled for. And it's uncalled for that George Floyd had a knee on his neck for 8 minutes and I think 46 seconds. It's uncalled for that Ahmaud was running through a neighborhood. I'm a runner. I run through neighborhoods all the time and someone hunted him down and killed him. That's not okay. This stuff has happened way too much. I'm pissed. I'm outraged. Again, I wanted to talk to our student athletes before having this conversation or releasing a statement. and I'm here to serve them. And I wanted them to understand my story. I wanted them to understand that this doesn't just happen to what is portrayed as thugs on television. It can happen to anyone. It can happen to your athletic director. It can happen to that woman who walking right behind me. It can happen to anyone of color. And that's not right. That's racism. That's systemic. That's institutional racism that we have to fight against. And I promise that I will do better. I will do better for my sons and daughters. I will do better for the student athletes for which for whom I'm responsible for. And I feel afraid for our African-American student athletes. I feel afraid for our white student athletes and non-African-American student athletes who haven't had a chance to hear this story until now. This can happen to anyone. We shouldn't be marginalized. We shouldn't be systemically, racially profiled. We have to do better. And I promise you today that I will do better.
Now, I want to share that clip because of the story he tells. And it's a story that's all too familiar to black men and women in this country. But for me, that's not a part of my reality. And there's a good chance it's not a part of yours either. But it's vitally important that those of us who do not experience that are able to hear that story, and that we try to gain some level of insight into the different emotions that you would feel in that situation, knowing how some of those encounters with police have ended in the past. And then you have to deal with those emotions, and then they become normalized, because that's not normal. Living in fear of what might happen to you if you encounter the police should not be normal. And I know that for some of you, that's going to be very hard to hear. You're going to feel threatened by that story and by the issues that we talked about on the show yesterday. You're going to turn off your radio. You're going to mutter something about white guilt or an agenda, or that I'm being forced into talking about this by the powers that be. You might start a sentence with, "Yeah, but," or a sentence with, "Well, what about?" Maybe you'll dig for some stats that make you feel better, or that you believe in some way, some twisted way, that makes what happened to George Floyd okay, or not that big of a deal. And that's all complete and utter crap. There is no statistic or explanation that would make what happened to George Floyd okay. Listen, I have more to lose from talking about this than I gain from it. If this were about self-interest, I would do the safe thing and I would just talk sports right now. That's the safe thing. Do 3 hours of non-threatening, safe sports radio and say that all we talk about here is sports. This is the place where you can escape. That would be the thing that everybody listening could probably agree upon. But that would be tone deaf and that'd be ignorant. Or I could do the thing where I say that looting is bad and I could just focus on that and make that the issue instead of the actual issue. Listen, I'm never going to defend looting. It's moronic when it happens after a sports team wins or loses, and it's tragic when it takes place right now because it gives the people the opportunity, some people, to change the subject, to say, yeah, but what about the looters? There's a distinction to be made between protesters and looters. There's a distinction to be made between people leading and participating in peaceful protests and demanding justice and the folks rushing into the Patagonia store in Santa Monica and grabbing surfboards. The killing of George Floyd is completely and utterly outrageous and unacceptable. I mean, surely we can all agree on that, right? And the fact that it's a pattern that keeps happening is what we're talking about here. That doesn't mean there aren't other problems in the world that need to be addressed, but this is the topic of the moment. I get if you feel threatened by the conversation from yesterday, but that's why I wanted to have that conversation. Because it's well past the time that white men had that conversation with each other, man to man. Yes, it's hard to hear. It's hard to be confronted by a reality by stories like Tim Duncan's and countless others. that is not the one that you and I experience every day. And it is really, really hard to maybe consider the way in which you and I might benefit from this system. And again, honestly, I'm no expert. Far from it. I'm a work in progress on this. I might make mistakes on this. But the only thing worse than saying the wrong thing right now is saying nothing at all. Again, I understand if you feel uncomfortable with this topic, but is the time to get comfortable being uncomfortable? It just is. And like Tim Duncan said, my agenda right now is to do better, and hopefully get this right. Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those most in need. To help, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who help us all. If you're hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your front line. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and the experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, visit LinkedIn.com/Rome, LinkedIn.com/Rome. Terms and conditions do apply, LinkedIn.com/ROME. Tim Corbin, Tim, it is so good to have you on. First off, how are you and everybody around you doing during this such very unusual time, Tim?
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate being on again. It's always good hearing your voice, but all is well, I guess, you know, generally speaking. For the most part, like yourselves and like many people that were around in our sports community, you're affected by a lot of different things going on right now and having a lot of conversations. And as you said, it's very healthy at this time.
We're talking to Tim Corbin. I'll talk to you, Tim, in a moment about the conversations. But if you were to go back, you won the championship last year, and then you started out this season. You were out here in Southern California for the Southern California College Baseball Classic. Then you went back to Nashville to face Toledo on March 11th. That turned out to be the final game of the season. What do you remember about that time and receiving the news that the season was about to be suspended?
Yeah, it was odd. Just because the week before we came out to L.A., we had a tornado, which was March 2nd, 3rd, right around that date. And, you know, most of East Nashville and Germantown was crushed by that. And then once we get back to L.A. after that, our mode was to try to help the community a little bit while we're playing baseball. And as you mentioned, we finished, I think it was March 11th, and March 12th, our season came to an end. And then 13th, the president declares a state of emergency. So, you know, at that time right there, it's just gathering the troops and being able to put perspective and shape the situation for them, because it's a national health issue. And at that point right there, our season no longer mattered. You know, it was bigger than us, and everyone was losing something. So, you know, I had just had to, what I felt was, gear the kids with next step. Now it's time to act professionally, and they're trained to be mature and make good decisions. And in times of uncertainty, then we want to act with certainty and confidence. So just to explain our situation, what we were going to lose, and they just had the responsibility to move forward, take care of themselves so they could keep others healthy around them. And that was kind of our function at that time.
What a great message. Vanderbilt head baseball coach Tim Corbin is joining us. You know, Tim, I've so enjoyed our conversations in the past about your approach to leadership and developing a program. So how have you gone about staying in touch with your players and continuing to develop and build that chemistry during this challenging time?
Right. Well, when you're running a program right now, you're doing it in isolation for the most part. You know, once we left one another in March, 15th or 16th, then no longer seeing the players and no longer seeing the staff. So there's a lot of communication with calls, and that's been healthy for certain. I think the frustrating part of the communication, though, is the mystery of what's going on and how we can help them, because there's not a lot of clear messages right now. They're ambiguous, and we will get back. We'll go to school again. We feel like we're going to be in the midst of playing athletics again. But, you know, at the same time, we're just trying to gear them to make sure that mentally and physically they're keeping their health. And I say mental because the mental part of this is just as important as the physical. So just trying to help them in any regard, and certainly navigating the next week and communicating a lot of issues with them that way too. But I just think communication is the best thing. And we all look forward to the time we have human interaction again, whatever that may look like. But we're craving that right now.
Vanderbilt head baseball coach Tim Corbin joining us once again. You know, Tim, when we talk about the program, it's so easy to focus on guys like David Price, Sonny Gray, and the list goes on. But The Athletic recently did a piece on all of your former players who have gone on to have successful careers in various parts of front offices and coaching in major league organizations, as well as coaching in college. How much pride then is there for you when you see all that?
There's a tremendous amount, because I think that has all, it's the reason you come to college. It's the reason that you educate yourself, because at some point in time, your window of opportunity playing the game that you enjoy is going to be gone. And you can't lose your identity over this. And I think, you know, going back to, which is close to you, January 26th, I think the loss of Kobe was so devastating because of what it did, his impact of his death from a national perspective. He was basically modeling the behaviors of what a professional athlete looks like when he takes off his, in his case, his Superman cape and transitions to fatherhood and parenthood. And essentially what you're doing at that point is you're releasing your own personal needs and focusing on others. And in this case, it was his children, his wife, but, you know, the amateur female basketball community while being there for others. And I just thought his loss, it was devastating so many different ways, because the strength of what he was doing was he was using other skill sets to empower young females in the sport of basketball, and just showing how to integrate himself with the regular Joes in life, and wasn't insulating himself. He was integrating with the masses. I mean, you look at the helicopter, and everyone in that helicopter were just regular Joes like me. And then showing other athletes that you don't have to lose your identity and your self-esteem when your sport is finished. Instead, use your skill sets and apply them to others. And he was using his education. And I know he didn't go to college, but yet, everyone knows, you know, his travel experiences because his dad, and living in other countries and speaking other languages and being well-read. I just thought he was modeling things that other athletes needed to see. And that's, you know, inside of this program, that's what we try to model for these kids. Because once it's over, and once they're 35 and 36 and 37, you don't want to get lost in just baseball. There's someone else. And playing in sport, in college or professionally, does not arm you with tools to solve challenges. But using sport to gain an education and develop your brain and your mental faculties does. And that's what Kobe did.
Tim Corbin is the head baseball coach of Vanderbilt. Tim, today is the fourth anniversary of the passing of Donnie Everett. You and I have talked about him in the past. But for those who do not know, how would you describe Donnie as a person?
Fun. I mean, he was big. You know, he's 6'2", 6'3", about 230 pounds. The skills, you know, from a pitching standpoint, the last pitch he threw was at the SEC tournament and was 101 miles an hour, and that was his freshman. But I think the thing about him was just the comfort you got being around him. He showed his teeth a lot. He was a smiler. And because of that, he just attracted other people to him, to the point where, you know, he was in the center of everything. If the kids were going out, he was going out with them. If there was fun in the locker room, he was in the middle of it. And I think when you look at players that you're with and people that you're around and people that you work with inside your studio, it's those moments right there. It's your ability to grow close to them because of your affection and their humor. And he had a tremendous personality, and he's the best reflection of his mom and dad. And that one will linger forever. That wound is still deep.
We're talking to Tim Corbin. Tim, shortly after his passing, James Franklin joined you and the team for a road series in Fayetteville, Arkansas. What did it mean to you to have him there with you at that time?
Oh, tremendous amount. I mean, I think, you know, my wife called James and just said, I think Tim needs you right now. And, you know, we've always been there for one another, you know, even when he was going through his tough time here at, you know, Vanderbilt with the rape case and the residual that came after that. And we were with him, he and Fumi, his wife. So I think there's reciprocal care for one another. I mean, he cares about what I'm doing. I care about what he's doing, much beyond, you know, the level of play and what we're doing on the fields. And we've got that relationship, but it was great. It was great for the kids. It was great for me, certainly, selfishly, to have another male influence that can somehow understand what you're going through. And, you know, when you're sitting in this chair, it's not always easy because not always everyone understands what you're going through, with the exception of the person that you sleep with. So it's not easy, and I'm just glad that he was around at that time.
Yeah, Tim, I think about the relationship you have with him, and then I think about the relationships you have with some of the other coaches. Like, for instance, Jerry Stackhouse and I have talked about how he wants to learn from you. Notre Dame defensive coordinator Clark Lee talks about what you've meant to him. There are so many other coaches who say the same thing. So what's it mean to you to be in that position and know that you have impacted so many other coaches in other sports the way you have?
It's just great to have those types of relationships because of my ability to teach at the college level. And I don't take any of it for granted. I mean, I see everyone as just regular humans. The fact that they're carrying a position or a role is one thing, but the fact that you can learn from them and want to learn from them, and whether it's those two you mentioned, whether it's Brad Stevens or Chip Kelly or any of those guys, I enjoy the relationship of just learning, because in my mind, before they're coaches, they're teachers. And I've always been drawn to teachers, and I've always been drawn to older teachers that impacted my life and certainly have impacted my life in the last 20 to 30 years. And when you can be around people like that, that really, really want to learn and are very curious about what's going on, then it has tremendous impact. But I'm just grateful for those relationships.
Tim Corbin, my guest. Tim, one last thought. Jensen Lewis said that when you first arrived, I want to read you a quote. He just walked in and it wasn't, "Hi, I'm Tim Corbin." It was, "I need all of you to take the batteries out of your cell phones or turn them off." We all looked at each other like, are we in the right place? What's going on here? It was captivating from that moment. It was not going to be anything we had ever experienced before, end quote. So what do you remember about that first meeting with the team, and what were you looking to convey to them?
I was just looking to convey attention more than anything else, and not in a militaristic way, but just to give them a belief system of what this program could possibly look like. And I was just trying to blend my personality into theirs more than anything else. And I think I've learned how to do that by being a step parent, because when I came into Maggie's life with the two girls, that's what I was doing. So I felt like I could use my personal experience to do that as a teacher and coach. But at the same time, I wanted their attention. I wanted them to be centered. It's centered on something that I wanted them to be passionate about, not because of me, but because of what they were doing for one another. And I realize it may have been a little bit different than what they were exposed to before. And I wasn't trying to change any culture. I was just trying to come in and use my personality with theirs and formulate the energies to move forward. And that was a good first step, because we gained a lot of energy in that first year. And, you know, from that point forward, it just took years and years of knocking on a door before we felt like we developed some consistency and some type of success. But the success we see isn't always on the scoreboard. It's based around a lot of these relationships and conversations that we have with these kids, and much like Jensen, who, you know, is still we're very fond of.
Well, to me, that's the right conversation at the right time. He is the head baseball coach at Vanderbilt. The 2021 season will be his 19th as head baseball coach there, and he was inducted into the American Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame earlier this year. My guest, Tim Corbin. Tim, I appreciate you so much, and it's great to have you back on. I always look forward to that. I always learn something from it, and it's great to have you, Tim.
You're nice to say that. Thank you very much, Jim. You be careful.
joined by Kurt Warner. It's great to have you back on. How are you?
Doing well. How you doing, Romy?
Good, good, Kurt. In fact, let me ask you this. I know you've been affected by what's happening in the country right now. So then how are you feeling, and then what kind of thoughts have you had specifically?
Well, I'm feeling like everyone else, you know, angered and disgusted by the stuff we're seeing in our country, confused on how we're still here after all these years in 2020. And then I think that the biggest question is where do we go from here? What can we do? You know, there me being a white American, what can I do? A guy with a platform, way to be able to use my platform to incite some changes. And I think those are the biggest questions. And I'm trying to listen and learn and understand Dan better, because, you know, that's the bottom line is I know I'm never going to fully understand, you know, what Black Americans are going through, and you know what my brothers and sisters are dealing with, and we're seeing some of the stuff, but we can't fully understand and grasp that. So the bottom line is I'm trying to listen, and I'm trying to figure out the best way to be able to use my position to make a difference.
Kurt Warner is joining us. You know, Kurt, to that point, you said that you wished you had had more conversations with your teammates about injustice when you were playing, but those conversations really did not take place at that time. And do you get the sense that maybe those conversations are taking place now more between players in ways that maybe they didn't back in the day?
Yeah, I do, and I hope they are. You know, I think you know, unfortunately, you know, when I was playing, I didn't see it as much as we see it now, for whatever reason that is, because things are being captured and being shown or whatever that is. Never really had that conversation with any of my teammates, but now that I believe that it's out there and you're hearing more, you know, coaches saying I'm getting my guys together and we're having open forum and we're having dialogue and, you know, we're learning these things, is that, you know, when I was playing, you know, it was always about, you know, building relationships with my teammates, regardless of, you know, their background or color or anything else, you know, that may have been different about it. But it just wasn't a conversation in regard to the daily struggle, that didn't have those daily conversations. And I wish I could have gotten a better understanding of, you know, stepped in and started to do something or tried to do something, you know, much earlier in the game than where we're at now or where I'm at now. But unfortunately it happened. And now I think we're having conversations, and now we got to do our best moving forward to figure out how we can make changes and do things differently.
NFL Network analyst Warner, Kurt, I appreciate your thoughts on that. Shifting to football, you and Brian are now in your third season film session. From the outside, it's how much passion and enthusiasm you for film study. When did you get hooked on film study?
I mean, that's always been my favorite part of the game, is the X and O's and the cat and mouse game and what one side is doing and how to counter that on the other side. That's always been my greatest passion. You know, even love to think the game. I always felt like that was one of my greatest strengths, was, you know, being able to see and react and think faster and better than my opponent. And so it's always been something that I've been passionate in, and, you know, do a little of that Sunday show, being able to, you know, call me the guy. So I love breaking down, but I've never had the opportunity to do it to depth that I've always wanted to do it. And so I'm always looking for opportunities and platforms to do that. And so the fiction is incredible, because, you know, it's one thing to watch film of an individual and kind of come up with a perspective of, okay, what they're seeing or what they're thinking on a play. But the thing to get in the room with those guys and to be able to talk those things and ask them, you know, sometimes you talk to another quarterback, so it's easy to get that language. Other times you're talking to a defense guy, and, you know, the guy that you've always encountered, you're hearing their perspective and what looking at it and why playing the game the way that they played the game. And so it's just fascinating. And, you know, then on top, I think you get the opportunity to meet some of the young superstars or some superstars in our game and to know them personally and get to know what they put into their craft. I think it's another element of it that I just really, really enjoyed. And so you put all those passion together, and I think we've come with a really great product that not a lot of people are doing. And so for the true football fan that wants to get to know these guys and get inside the game a little bit, these film sessions are incredible.
Warner joining us. All right, to that point, Deshaun Watson is the featured player guest for the first episode of Film Session. When you look at him on tape and you break him in terms of X's and O's, what do you see when you watch him play?
Yeah, you know, I love Deshaun, and we've had a relationship for a while and kind of gone back and talked a lot. But once again, you hear stories, even when he was a rookie, and I went down and covered training camp, was talking to Bill O'Brien and just kind of asking him about Deshaun and what he sees. And he told me, you know, the main thing is that he's always seeing things that, you know, that you're not really seeing until after a play. And he comes back and says, this is why I did this and I did that. So I'd always heard those things about Deshaun. And then you watch film. You look at it and you go, can I see this, or did he fall into that? You know, was he able to see all of this stuff going on? And so that was the impressive part for a young guy that's still growing to the position. You know, his ability to see the field and visualize and understand what he was seeing and being able to build off of, you know, something that happened early in a game and then the same play call later in the game, and he's able to recollect what happened on the first play and how that plays in the way he plays the second play. You know, just fascinating to watch, and it's things that you get excited about because he's such a great young man, first and foremost, and he's so talented. When you start to understand his level of knowledge for the game, you understand the sky's the limit when you put all those things together. And so I'm excited to see how he continues to grow, but really had a great time getting to sit with him in that setting, because even though we had that relationship, we never really got a chance to sit down and go over film together. And it was incredible.
Kurt Warner is joining us. And then Kurt, on the other side of the ball, in the second episode of Film Session, you focus on Stephon Gilmore. What is it that makes him so and so unique as a cornerback?
I think, you know, when you talk about great players, there's always things that infiltrate who they are. Of course, they're talented at what they do, and they've got a skill set. But there's an attention to detail. And that was the thing, you know, Stephon, a number of times, and he's a little more soft-spoken. But his craft is really important to him, and his intelligence. And I think that's why he's really excelled and been the player he's been in England, is because you get him around Bill Belichick, and you use that talent and that desire to know more and to use the mental side of the game coupled with the physical side of the game. And I believe he's learned and taken on so much of that knowledge from what they're trying to do. And again, the fun part is to hear that stuff, because it's easy to see a guy and go, man, that's really good at playing corner. He's a lockdown corner. But then when you talk to him about technique and what he's thinking and why he does certain things that he does, the understanding of where other guys are on the football field and how that helps him as a cornerback, it's fascinating stuff to me. When I ever played those positions, I know what goes into playing quarterback. I don't know some of the nuances that go into some of the positions. And to hear a guy like that's playing at the top of his game, but listen to him talk about the nuance and how he thinks the game, to me, always the most impressive part, because I think all the ones, as talented as they are, they understand how to think the game. Their mind is where they separate themselves from everybody else.
We're talking to Kurt Warner. Kurt, so there have been comparisons of late made in you and Joe Burrow. I'm curious, what reaction when
I think you're always to be compared to any player, a guy that's been, you know, successful like Joe was, especially last year. And I understand where they're coming from. You know, I think when you watch Joe play here, you know, they were a team that to get five guys out. They love to put pressure on the defense. You know, the quarterback was to make quick decisions, get the ball out of his hands, be accurate with the foot. And those were all things that were my great strengths when I played the game. And so I completely understand where the comparisons come from. I don't really know Joe well, but I go way back with this, because his dad actually was a defensive back for us when I played arena football. So I've known the family for a long time. And so I'm just pulling for Joe and hoping to take what he did last year in college and bottled up and be able to use that same skill set and did really well now in the NFL as a chance to blossom into to a good quarterback.
Kurt, before I let you go, you recently tweeted out a shirtless picture of flexing. As you and I have talked in the past, you're still getting after it. You're still staying in shape. Not everybody does that in retirement. What motivated you to stay on that grind?
I think, first of all, it becomes a part of your life. And you get used to working out. But I think the biggest thing is I just want to be able to be active as long as possible, whether that be chasing my kids or now chasing my grandkids, being able to be active with them. I want to be able to coach or teach or whatever that is moving forward. And I feel like I've got a lot to accomplish. And I think that's the biggest thing is that you know, when I finished playing football, I didn't feel like that was the best chapter of my life. My life, as great as it was, I feel like I got 40 years left to be able to make impact again. And I think the best way to do that is to stay in shape and to stay healthy and put yourself in a position where you feel like you can do anything you want to do. And that's what I try to do.
Great message. One last thought then. What's your approach? Are you hitting the weights? Are you still playing basketball? Are you still doing cardio? It's some combination of all of the above. How are you doing it?
All of the above. And so I'm still lifting. And, you know, I do cardio, something every day. I'm shooting baskets, as you said. I'm not really playing during the pandemic, but I'm still out there, you know, shooting and creating some kind of cardio workout around shooting the basketball. So every day is something a little bit different. You know, I've even been out running sprints, and, you know, I've posted that a couple times, done, you know, 300-yard shuttles, which were things we did as conditioning tests back when I played in the league. And so right now it's just about being creative so I don't get bored, but just making sure I do something every day to stay active and to stay fit, and it kind of runs the gamut.
He is an NFL Network analyst, member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. As a reminder, the third season of Film Sesh is available today on NFL Game Pass, and it features Kurt Warner and Brian Baldinger breaking down game film. The first five episodes of Film Sesh will air on NFL Network Saturdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, beginning June 6th. Great product. Kurt, great day on the show, as always, and I appreciate the relationship over the years. Kurt, thanks so much.
You bet, buddy. Take care. Stay safe.
My man is almost like a perfect interview, if there is such a thing. Like, they created Kurt in a lab. Like, he's so analytical, so anecdotal, so personable, so interesting. I mean, he really is an amazing person to talk to. Thanks to Kurt Warner. All right, when we come back, we'll go back-to-back. Ode Abushi, Lions offensive lineman, joins me next. Stay open. After the interview, we've got half a gram left. And plenty of opportunity to get through. 1-800-636-8686. Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially frontline workers who provide resources and care for those who are most in need. Help out. LinkedIn is our free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that quickly fill. The 26th version. Judging on the run-up to the event, the main event is going to be insane. I'm fully expecting one of the best smack-offs ever, even during these really challenging times. So with that said, let me go ahead and continue with the player profile feature that I've been doing since the start of the smack-off season. Today's player profile is arguably the most bent dude in the jungle. Mac in Boston, a.k.a. Mark the Nomad on Twitter. The reason Mark is so bent is because last year he spent SmackOff 25 listening to SmackOff 25 on hold. But on the Monday after the main event, he called in to warn everybody that he would be coming back this year with a vengeance, the vengeance of which we have never seen before. And he continued that theme last month when he made this phone call.
All you golden ticket winners, they're going to call in the golden hour and go full golden down your leg when you hear Jim go to you. I'm not the one you're looking for. Aim lower. Try Vic. He's always looking for the next Dr. Dave to eviscerate and then run to Twitter to brag. You want absolutely none of this. Hey, Brad. You've won five of these things, and you still sell insurance with Reggie? Bro, you could have your own show in the middle of the night that no one listens to and have a local sponsorship from a chicken wing restaurant like Sean. And Rick, you're a science teacher, right? I have a physics question for you about gravity. Why are you able to grow hair on your face but not your head? It doesn't make sense. Did it just fall down there? You cannot cover up ugly, Rick. Hey, and sweet call, Benny. What does it say about your smack-off call when you're, quote, tactical error was the most entertaining part of your call? I can guarantee you this, Jim. I am the best to ever relocate from Boston to Tampa. I'm not going to be calling my family members drunk bitches. I'm not going to cower and try to atone for past sins like the Cablin Asian soft ass. I'm not going to drunk dial on game day and make a Tony Kornheiser joke. It's just going to be me and a spiked bat.
And a bunch of you, quote, going golden down your leg. Come on, man. In terms of him, it's just going to be me and a spike bat. I do believe that part. I do believe that part because I've seen him break out that bat. I've seen him swing the lumber, and so has Team Canada.
Matt, you and Tyler are so irrelevant. Rome had to create an 11th and 12th place just for you guys last year. We're the Americans.
And right now, the Americans are trolling Brova Scotia or Saskatchewan or whatever the hell you call those weird provinces, looking for Canadian girls to feed, trying to convince them they don't need to hunt for their food, they can gain independent wealth outside of the flannel factory, and that by joining the Americans, they can actually touch the Stanley Cup. We tried to recruit a celebrity, but we just couldn't seem to find anyone. We reached out to Michael J. Fox, but he said he couldn't shake free of his previous engagements.
So Mark, the most bent man in the jungle. He may never have won a smack off, but he has been in three of them. He does have a top five to his name. So he's not afraid to swing in that weight class. He can punch up. In fact, it's not a matter of punching up. He belongs in that weight class. And just like Brad and Vic and the other Mark, he has taken plenty of runs at the double champ from Laguna for all of the gimmicks in his past.
Most people think Leff regressed last year after winning two in a row and then finishing third last year. Me personally, that was actually his best call, mostly because, well, he was hardly in it. I mean, I'm all for Leff adding as many sound effects, cameos into his call as possible at this point. Seriously, it's starting to sound like the week that was an Alvin DeLauro production, all repurposed, glitched, and poorly produced. JK Alvy, we all know you're a great producer and an even better reproducer like me. Henry Winkler, Ron Fahey, Larry Brown, good night now.
You can tell. I mean, I was laughing throughout. The guy made me laugh throughout. That was one of Leff's best calls because he was hardly in it. Alvy's a great producer, but a better reproducer like me. All right, so when you hear that, you wonder, what are his odds? He's currently going off at 6-1 at Stucknut.com. Again, those are not the official odds. Unofficially, 6-1 at Stucknut. It's just one man's opinion. But then again, all odds are, right? It's a reflection of the betting public. We're not taking, you can't get down at Stucknut.com. Seems about right, though. 6-1, if that were a real thing, it sounds about right. I mean, you can't really put this guy or slot this guy without the hardware ahead of Brad or Leff or the Calvination. But it does say everything, if you believe that type of thing, that he's not that far down the board either. So the question now is, can Mark in Boston, Mark the Nomad, channel all of that anger and frustration and hate into 4 minutes that will make him just the 15th champ in Smack Off history? I want to make that point again. Only 14 people have ever won the event. I've been running this event for a quarter of a century. There have only been 14 champs. This guy's been showing up a lot lately. He's getting in his reps. To me, it's a smart move for somebody who has not competed in a smack-off since 2017. So the proverbial question in sports, is it a case of rest or rust? You tell me.
What's up, ladies? Guys like Tyler, Sarah T, Matt, Callan Vegas, if you're on hold, hang up. I don't know how else to say this. You aren't good at calling the show. Ain't it weird, though, how I didn't call last year but still placed the same as Tyler?
The run you're giving Caleb right now is the furthest this dude's ever run in his life. The kid is out of breath just listening.
Gino, my God, dude, shut up already.
War Rich Flores still not understanding that he's been the punchline for like 3 days.
Mark in Hollywood, I've seen Tom Brady on TV more as an actor than I've seen you. He's not only the best at his job, he's better at yours than you are. I am Detroit-born and brought up in freaking Florida. I've got the blood of a scumbag, and I was raised by Florida Man. You want Florida Man clones? You got Florida Man. A dangerous mix. The guy who will burn down your whole neighborhood and then walk his pet alligator on a leash around the flames. Caleb, a quick rule about jokes. If you have to explain them, they're not good. You're the only dude who would crowdsource the funds to buy Rome a baseball bat from a movie about basketball. What a bad look for DA. How much longer is CBS going to keep paying him
when they realize a teacher from Buffalo and a stay-at-home dad in Corona are better at talking sports than him. Hey, DA, how is it possible that your call could actually make me want to hear more Matt in L.A.? Hey, I love how Mike continues to get worse each year as he continues to tell us how great he is. Does Romo cut up lines of creatine when he's at your table and offer you the mirror like, you want to hit this, bro?
I just think it's kind of odd that NASCAR is the only sport where there's literally a crankshaft right in the driver's face the whole time. Oh, sorry, wrong segment. War playing Connect Four on Seal's face.
Jim, I know the challenge before me is great. The odds are long. But much like Antonio Cromartie when he found out his wife's tubes were tied, challenge accepted.
This dude. He's got to make the Smackoff better. He will. It's been 2 years since we've had him on. On paper, just his presence already adds another monster to this entire thing. I got a good feeling this guy's getting on this year. I have a good feeling this guy is getting on this year. Welcome back, Mark. And welcome everybody to Smack Off Month. Let's do this damn thing.
Mom, my phone call to the Jim Rome show was like a smuggled heroin balloon at an airport. Rectum.
Who wants to walk with Jeff from Richmond?
Way to go, Daniel. Never heard that one before. But I guess we should expect that kind of trash. Coming from a guy who throws surprise birthday parties for his cat.
I'm a starving tiger for the title King of Smash.
I want to come flying out of the ass of Cruz's car on that parachute that deploys out of nowhere for no reason whenever they cross the finish line.
Smack Off 26, June 19th.
The single greatest day of my life.
It is for the best of the best. It's invite only. Some of the biggest players.
You horse tooth jackass.
What the hell was the point of that, badass?
Some of the dirtiest players in the game. Caleb.
Don't mess with the walrus, young man. You'll get the tough.
Maybe you should just bring your mama. And she can apologize for being such a failure as a parent.
Cal in Vegas.
Rick, you ain't gonna do nothing. As soon as you get down here, I'm putting you in a chokehold. And I'm not letting go until your face turns the same color as your bright red alcoholic nose.
Get to the end of those double rainbows.
Double
Will
rainbow.
There be two pals in Vegas with a pot of gold?
The Canadians.
Oh. You better go.
That's not a good call.
Jesus Christ. Can somebody please collectively get these nerds some hookers?
Mark in Hollywood.
What up, sluts? Tough snack talk. Canadians, really?
Mark, we gotta get you some hair plugs, man.
Benny.
And I'll bet you 5,000 pine cones that you'll be looking up at me again. Lump these, Maddie.
Left in Laguna.
And Benny, two words you don't want to hear from Romy after your call.
Tactical error.
Made a tactical error.
30 dudes in a phone call. Gimmicky bitches like us.
Jeff in Southfield.
Jim, you're literally my bestest friend.
Mike in Indy.
Jeff received the ultimate compliment any Smack-Off caller could ever receive. At one point, everyone thought he was me.
Vic.
See, that's what I do. I provide content. I supply the stuff that keeps this whole operation afloat.
Rick in Buffalo.
There's a reason why Vic's unranked, and I'm the world's number one contender. Not back to the basement, Victor!
Sean, the Cablonasian.
Shawnee, the Mayonnaisian.
I pick up the phone, I call, I win. I win more than anybody because I am the best at this. Always have been, always will be.
Five-time champ, Brad, in Corona.
R.I.P. to Shawnee's radio career and his pulmonary arteries. At this point, it's a toss-up as to which one's going to go first. But personally, Jim, I'm rooting for the arteries.
$5,000.
Good God.
Not without an invite, you're not.
Jim, I do think to him that you would have been to a barnyard animal.
Patriot, brah, citizen, brah.
Me being left on hold was the worst thing to ever happen to all of you.
Get alive, loser.
Do me a favor and forget my name.
What's my name, boo?
And the rest of you just need to clear your calendar. June 19th. Let's do this.
We're done when I say we're done.
Alvy with the promo. Somebody's getting left on hold again this year. I'm not sure who it's going to be. I only say that because I'm not coming for somebody, but the field is that deep. Ode Abushi joins me right now. Ode, it's nice to have you on. First off, how are you and everybody around you doing during this really unusual time?
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on here. We've been doing good. You know, we've been able to stay healthy, and we've been able to be blessed throughout this time. And you know, I know it's been a tough time for New York City, so you know, doing everything we could to do our part as a fellow New Yorker, as a fellow human, to to give back and try to support people as much as we can during this time.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that very thing. Like, if we were to go back a little bit, you did play your high school ball in Brooklyn. Earlier in the offseason, you were at your home in New York City before you decided to leave. What was life like in New York as COVID-19 was becoming more of a threat?
You know, things got really eerie. You know, the city has so much energy and it's constantly vibrant, constantly something to do and things to do. And then, you know, in a matter of a couple of days, you know, things just went flat. So it had really a movie vibe to it as far as, you know, things being so out of picture and things being so different. Because, you know, obviously something like this, we haven't experienced, you know, to kind of deflate a city like that. So it was definitely odd, you know, to see everybody bundled up and everyone inside and not really, you know, enjoying the city for what it really was.
Ode Abushi is joining us. And then your brother is a second-year resident at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn. At one point, you were dropping off protective gear for him. How is he doing?
He's doing great, yeah. Like you said, he's in the middle of his residency right now in Brooklyn. He was actually one of his hospitals that he rotates that were admitted as a COVID hospital. So he was on the front lines of it. And this was the very beginning, you know, when they were running out of PPE and they were unable to get, you know, the supplies they really need to get. So, you know, I was able to pull together some supplies, drop some N95 masks off to him and some disinfectant sprays and things of that sort and let him, you know, at the end of the day, it's a part of his job, you know, and I think everybody in the medical profession right now are the true heroes during this time, and they make that ultimate sacrifice to really go out there and put themselves and their family at risk, you know, to help a complete stranger. So for me to be able to, you know, to assist him in being as selfless as he possibly can, you know, it was a small little token I could have done to, you know, at least try to help him help other people.
Well said. Ode, so let me ask you this. You and your family, or you and your wife, I should say, made the decision to leave the city and head to New England. What made you decide to do that? And then what's a normal day like for you right now?
Well, we actually came up to Rhode Island. You know, New York being closed down, a lot of gyms were closed. A place I normally was able to get my training in at had closed down. So a buddy of mine I went to high school with, he had a gym he owns up in Rhode Island, in which he opened up to me. He's been closed for the last 2.5 months. So I was able to go in there and get my work. So that was really the main motivation behind coming up to Rhode Island to be able to get my work in and stay sane. But for me, in normal days, I get up, you know, I knock on my Zoom meetings with my team. I come in, I train for a couple hours, try to do some recovery rehab after that. And then I coast really, you know, the rest of the day. I hang out with the wife, you know, we're able to continue to try to, you know, help the city as much as we can. Hopefully get another food drive in next week. This time it'll be in Staten Island. You know, we'll be able to distribute another 35,000 pounds of produce. So, you know, just trying to stay active, you know, stay mentally focused, stay, you know, actively in the times we're in. And honestly, you know, this is a bigger time than COVID-19 for us. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, just put ourselves out there and make ourselves as available as we can to everybody.
Ode Abushi is joining us, and I definitely want to get to that part of it, too. In terms of working out, so you've got the friend, he's got the gym, nobody else was using it. So what was it like to work out during Ramadan? How did you go about approaching that?
So Ramadan, honestly, kept the schedule the same. Eating was a little different. You know, I would try to stay up as late as I can and, you know, try to sleep in as much as I can. And then I would get up and go train. And knocking my training out, you know, my training really didn't train. My fueling for the training was a little different as Ramadan went through, the way I would eat and how I tried to approach that. But, you know, the first week is always the toughest because your body goes, you know, from a normal routine to, you know, straight fasting. So it's a little bit of a transition. But, you know, once you get down a routine, your body's able to adjust and adapt to that and move forward. So it was, you know, for me, I've been doing this for about 12 years, you know, while observing Ramadan and playing football, whether it was at high school, college, and now in the league, I've been able to do it.
Ode, your family is absolutely amazing. Like I mentioned, your brother is a second-year resident. Another sister is a surgeon. One is preparing to be a nurse. Your sister, Tahani, is running for Manhattan District Attorney, and she makes the point that this commitment to helping others is, quote, a no-brainer. It's how we were taught, make a difference, end quote. When you were growing up then, what did your family teach you about the importance of making a difference? What was the message?
Honestly, the message was always, you know, treat people like you want to be treated. And in the position where we are, we've been very blessed, to be in the position we are today. But, you know, we didn't get these positions easily. We didn't, you know, overnight, you know, be a nurse or a doctor or running for DA. You know, this is something, you know, that was prepped to us as kids as far as, you know, the way we would treat people, the way we interacted with people, you know, the businesses we owned, you know, forced us to be selfless and reach out to communities and be in communities and work with people that we ideally never work with. So growing up, You know, I felt like that transition helped us open our eyes to all different kinds of cultures and different kind of religions. And at the end of the day, ultimately, you know, for us as a family, I could honestly say, like, we don't see color. You know, we don't see a religion. We don't see, you know, we don't recognize people based off of how they look. You know, being a civil rights attorney or a doctor, and being in a position where, you know, you devote your lifetime, you devote your career to helping others, you know, you have no choice but to be, you know, but to see that and be raised that way. So for us, you know, always growing up, our parents always instilled in us, you know, treat people how you want to be treated, no matter what they are in life, no matter what position you hold. And for us, you know, carrying that mantra, carrying that quote with us throughout life really prepared us and helped propel us into the position we are today.
Odeh Abushi is joining us, a member of the Detroit Lions. So to that point, last week, you and your sister donated 35,000 pounds of food in the city. It's a massive amount. What was the experience like, and how good did it feel to be able to give back like that?
It was amazing. You know, we teamed up. We can't take all the credit for that. We teamed up with a bunch of community members, PCNY. You know, hats off to them. It was really their initiative. We were able to help, you know, distribute everything and get it out. But it was honestly, it was overwhelming with the kind of gratitude we were able to, you know, feel through people. You know, at the end of the day, you know, we were able to give out boxes. We had people come up, pick up boxes, drop boxes off to soup kitchens and other places of need and other shelters throughout New York City where, you know, they didn't have as much access to food and things of that sort. And, you know, for us, it was the day. I mean, we handed out 35,000 pounds of produce in a matter of 3 hours. So you could imagine how fast and how, you know, much of a rush and things were just flying. So for us, you know, before we even kind of got a chance to realize exactly the extent of everything, you know, everything was gone. You know, the you know, people came and picked up multiple boxes and were able to, you know, feed families and, you know, people just being as grateful as they were and, you know, having the NYPD help us out on the front lines of two in the community and extending their hands out too. So overall, you know, it was an amazing effort by the community. It was an amazing effort by a lot of people across the board that really, you know, teamwork makes the dream work. And we were able to, you know, help out Harlem in that situation as much as we could.
Good for you. You know, I'm really curious. Your parents emigrated from Palestine. So what was life like for you growing up on 53rd Street and then on Staten Island?
It was fun. You know, for me, you know, I think being New York was one of the best things that could have happened to me growing up in New York City because it exposed me to so much diversity throughout my childhood. You know, New York City, you know, being born in Brooklyn, Sunset Park, and be around, you know, Spanish and Asians and that kind of community. And then, you know, growing up in Staten Island, obviously it's a different, more of a crowd there. You know, I went to high school still in Brooklyn, but, you know, primarily a white high school and things of that sort. So I saw a lot of, you know, and then going to Virginia, being as diverse of a school and being in the South now. So I was able to kind of see a lot of different cultures and things of that sort. And I really feel like, you know, being in that position, really, you know, for me, it helped me like relate to a lot of people, you know, not necessarily feel exactly how they feel, but to a certain point, I understand their struggle. I understand, you know, what they stand for, what they've been, you know, what they've been exposed to and things of that sort. So for me, you know, I feel like my tolerance level when it comes to dealing with people and understanding people is higher, you know, because of the way I grew up in the situation that I did grow up in.
Listen, before I let you go, speaking of growing up, I mean, I mentioned some of the accomplishments of your siblings. There's even more that I didn't even get to. So what was it like growing up as the ninth of 10 kids in a family of such highly motivated, successful people? How much did that inspire and motivate you?
You know, it was a lot of motivation. You know, you don't want to be that guy necessarily. You know what I'm saying? In this case, you don't want to be that child. So, you know, I think everybody, you know, fed off each other as far as we're motivated. You know, my parents wanted a big family. So, you know, at the end of the day, we never needed anybody but each other. So we constantly fed off each other for motivation, whether it was, you know, seeing my brother go through a huge trial, seeing my sister accept a huge surgical case, or, you know, seeing my brother or one of my other sisters graduate to college and vice versa. So seeing everybody accomplish, you know, their feat and their goals, you know, only motivated me more to kind of push to be the best of the best, whether I want to be an athlete, whether I was going to be a lawyer, a doctor, whatever it may be. You know, the constant motivation of seeing my siblings, you know, succeed and see how it trickled down, you know, in their life only made, you know, me motivated to kind of push it and fight for what I really wanted in life.
All right, so I'm curious. Every time I have a player on from the Lions on this show, we talk about the fan base in Detroit. It's a group that is so loyal, man. They've been through some hard times. You signed there last season. What did you make of the fans, and how hungry are you, or how hungry are they to win and have something to rally around and be excited about?
Yeah, you know, Detroit, you know, right off the bat, you drive to Detroit, man, you get that sense of a blue-collar city who's had so much history, who's had so much happen to them and you know, been through a really rough patch as far as, you know, their existence, you know, with the motor industry and, you know, Flint and everything like that. So, you know, Detroit, Michigan, you know, you go through that city and you feel nothing but a sense of work. You feel nothing but a sense of, you know, no matter how bad shit's going to get, you're going to continue to get up and pound away at the pavement. And, you know, that feeds off, you know, we feed off of that as fans, as players, because we see that mentality that fans have. And we know at the end of the day, you know, football has importance to everybody throughout America, and seeing the fans and how they translate. And people really look to that as a bit of a getaway. You know, when the game's on, they like to put things on pause and just enjoy the game and be in their space. So, you know, Detroit, they continue to motivate us, the fans. You know, every day they get up, they continue to go to work. You know, not the best, things are not the best, but they continue to just plug along. And for them to continue to have the attitude and that work ethic, I think it translates to us as a team. I think as players, we feed off of that. I think as players, we completely understand that, you know, the city, it's been through a lot, and it's time for the right thing to happen to the city and continue to start to turn things around to the city. So, you know, we've always been motivated by our fans. Our fans always been there for us, no matter what the record, no matter what the season's been like. Forest Field is always packed out, and it's always appreciated. And at the end of the day, we're just going to continue to put our best foot forward and give this city something to hold their hats on.
Odia, one last thought. You're one of a very small number of players with Palestinian roots who have played in the NFL, and you are regarded as the first Palestinian-American player to be drafted and stick with the team who drafted you. What's it mean to you to be a role model like that?
It's huge. You know, when I got drafted, you know, going through the whole process, there's so many things that could happen, right? There's 32 teams, there's 7 rounds. You don't know where you're going to get picked, what day, what team, what state you're going to end up. So there's a lot of unknown. And for me, you know, being drafted, you know, was huge that I found the home and I was able to, you know, continue my career and accomplish my goals. But, you know, it opened up to a whole nother side of me that I never expected, as far as, like, you know, the support that I had with my community, being able to punch through that gap, that line of, you know, there's not many Arab American players. It's not, you know, we don't play that sport, et cetera. So just continue to give kids hope that it don't matter whether you're Palestinian, you know, you're Muslim, whatever it is, you know, you continue to put in the work, you continue to put in the daily deposits. You're gonna accomplish your goal. You're gonna get to where you're gonna get. And, you know, being Palestinian and that whole history of the Palestinian history and the oppression that goes on there, you know, for me to give people hope and give people light and make people proud is a feeling that I can never really explain. I'm forever grateful for.
Mark in Hollywood. Hey Mark, how are you?
Yo, man, I'm doing great. This is kind of the weirdest RSVP call I've ever made, I would venture to think. But I really appreciated your show yesterday, for sure, as an African-American and kind of right here in Hollywood around the protests and things of that nature. Just to move the conversation forward, I was listening to you yesterday, and the calls were great, the stories about what people of color have to go through. But one thing that kind of struck me as I was kind of on Twitter and active and, you know, even this morning, why do people get mad because we're bringing this up? Like, what is there to get mad about by hearing this and by seeing black people get killed? Like, why does that make non-black people angry? Like, why are they turning off your show? You know, if a Caucasian person was like, hey, man, I need to tell you about this Caucasian experience, it's very indicative of my experience, I'd be interested in hearing that, because I'd be like, I don't really know that. That's interesting to me. I wouldn't be like, no, I don't want to hear that. You know, and when we talk about stories about being pulled over or being harassed, people respond to that like, oh, boo-hoo, get over it. But why? We're not taking anything away from you. No one wants to take away your rights and your life when we say Black Lives Matter. I don't want your life to be demeaned. I'm just casually nudging you saying, hey, we don't think our lives matter as much, and clearly they don't. My voice doesn't matter as much as a Caucasian person's voice. I don't believe that in my heart, but I believe that to be fact. And that is the difference. There's facts here. There's a fact that when I started in my relationship with my white girlfriend, I tried to approach it with humor. I'm like, look, if we're here, we've been about 6 months, you're going to probably need to know a few things about what it is to be black. And one of those things is at some point we're going to get pulled over for no reason. I'm just telling you that. It happens almost every 2 years to me. It's like clockwork. And when that happens, I need you to do the following. I need you to put your hands on the dash and I need you to roll film because something might happen. And when that day came and she thought I was joking, she saw it firsthand. And when I told people about it, they're like, oh my God, is that what you have to do? Is that what you have to prepare? You have to have a speech ready? Officer, I am reaching for my wallet. I am doing it slowly. It's that story shouldn't offend anybody. So I think that's where I'm at right now. I've kind of moved on, obviously, with the shock and being emotional about it. And I'm just trying to like talk to people. I'm like, look, bro, just because I'm going on Twitter and saying this and Black Lives Matter, I don't want to take anything away from you. No one is going to take your rights. But what about ours? All right, I'll see you on the Smack Off, kid.
I'll see you then, Mark. I appreciate you very much, and I appreciate your thoughts. Save that telephone call, Alvin. Craig is in Omaha. Nice to have you on the show. Craig, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Thanks a lot.
It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to let you know, yesterday when I heard the show, and I heard, I wasn't sure if someone had called in or texted or emailed you about, you know, talking about what's going on in the country. And to me, when I first heard it, Jim, it was basically, while Jim is getting the same shut up and entertain me that LeBron gets with the shut up and dribble. And this is what we have to deal with, individuals of no goodwill. It's just about moving the conversation forward, moving the process forward. I wish I could not listen to this. I wish I could not have to pay attention to this. Once I hang up, I'm getting ready to leave. I have to be careful of what I do when I go, you know, outside, when I go to the store. You know, being, you know, you turn around and, you know, really the security guard is sitting there watching you. You know, you're walking, riding your bike in the park, and literally the parent comes and grabs their little child, and it's like, I'm just riding, and it's like, okay. But you see this, you know, I'm 58 years old, and I've grown up with this in America. But I just want to thank you, Jim, for keeping the conversation going. A lot of people don't want to grow, and that's what this is about. You know, everyone knows the history of the country and what we've gone through, and we're still here. We're still citizens. We're good citizens. I was listening to your interviews, both with Kurt Warner and O'Day, and like him, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I wouldn't change it for the world because growing up in Brooklyn, you got such a wealth of experiences of individuals from around the whole world, and it opens up your eyes, and that's what I want to say, Jim. Thanks so much. Keep up the good work. Take care.
Thank you very much, Craig. I appreciate your thoughts. Let's go this time to Toronto. Chris, good to have you, Chris. How are you?
Hey, Rome. Hey, listen, I heard what you said last time about keeping my call short, but I just need a couple minutes today, if that's okay.
Yes.
Today really is not about a golden ticket, man. First off, thank you, Jim, for using a platform the way that you do to bring about change and healing and for being a place for the hurting, man. Just so I put everything out there, I'm from Toronto, but I actually live in the States. And I'm a black man out here hurting and looking for answers. I fear for myself, my children, my family. It's a dangerous time for someone with my skin color in America. So really, man, I'm just calling today to help move the conversation forward and still be optimistic that in my lifetime, we'll actually see real change for people of color so that my children are not having to march for change 20 years from now. Because, see, right now we're marching for George and Ahmaud and Breonna because we are hurting. We are tired. And we'd like to see reform with police and see indictments when black people are hunted and murdered. But we're also marching for Christian Cooper because make no mistake about it, Amy Cooper was trying to turn Christian Cooper into another hashtag when she tried to weaponize the police against him, pointing out an African-American man was attacking her, and he wasn't. It's those sense of attitude and actions done by people that are why we are marching. So when we say Black Lives Matter, we're not saying only Black Lives Matter. We're saying Black Lives Matter too. And we're asking you, the listeners, to join in that sentiment with us. Because if you care more about property than you do people, you're part of the problem. If you're more upset about the rights, seeking to understand the why behind it, you're part of the problem. Listen, I'm not for riots or looting. After 400 plus years of frustration and lack of justice, am I surprised by it? After how y'all did Kaepernick? No. But am I excusing it? No. So we as a people don't want for the main issue to be lost. Justice and fair treatment is what we want. Let's not allow for the looting and the rioting to be the main story. And I'll end with this. The listeners, please take some time to educate yourself on what's going on and actually time to listen to people's experience if you want to be a part of the change. We need you guys to be in the fight with us. If you're uncomfortable with this topic, welcome to our world. Thanks for the time, bro. Appreciate you, bro.
All right, Chris, thank you very much.
Good night now!